Okay, everybody, welcome to class for today. I'm sorry we're getting started a bit late. And I'm going to be sort of taking over my father's role in class today because he's developed a really bad cold and can barely talk and is limitedly coherent, maybe, on top of that.
Can we ask what he was doing this weekend?
He was learning how to edit videos.
I see.
A very trying activity, and marrying someone, which was very exciting event, I gather.
It was.
So I'm going to be attempting to take over. That's why I've invited the political blogs panel down here to help me out, because I'm hoping that you guys will help to invigorate the discussion today and that everybody in the class will sort of come to my rescue in this surprising situation that we're in. And I'm also especially excited to be doing this because we have a guest today who is John Palfrey, the director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and also a classmate of mine from Harvard Law School, and a person with whom I taught a class. We taught an Internet and Society class together at the Extension School for several years. So it's exciting for us to be back together and doing this. So
thanks,
welcome to class, John.
Thanks, Becca.
Our subject today is political blogs, and I just wanted to start off by giving John a sense of why we're talking about political blogs today, and maybe to give a sense of that to all of you guys also. We've just started on projects in this class. Every student in the class is finding some issue that they're passionate about, some issue on which they would like to create change, or an issue on which they would like to stop imminent change. And the objective is to figure out how to really make a persuasive argument for their position on that issue to an audience of people who are not like a regular jury in a courtroom, an audience of people who are not forced to sit there and listen to them. So we're in the situation in which you not only have to make a persuasive argument, but you have to draw the people in and engage them in order to be able to make the argument.
This class is called Law in the Court of Public Opinion, right?
Exactly. Law in the Court of Public Opinion. So where it's making an argument to the Court of Public Opinion.
All right.
So the objective with political blogs is to take a look at one of the most prominent and successful examples of people doing exactly this kind of project that we've seen. I mean, you know, you could say it's kind of lame that the Pope has a blog at this point, but there's a good reason why the Pope has a blog, which is that it's turned out to be a very effective means for people who use it well to actually do advocacy for positions that they would like to advocate for. And the political blogs are probably the most prominent example of people actually making change and being able to push back against the pressures of big media when they're writing these blogs and sort of muckraking on various issues that the media is ignoring or taking a particular slant on. So with that, I would just like to ask you, and maybe you guys on the panel, could we just get some kind of an introduction to what the lay of the land is for political blogs? What's going on in it? What are some big ones? And what makes people go read them?
I think it'd be much more fun to turn to the panel of political bloggers, don't you think, and to have me say anything.
Yes, I should say these people are people who signed up very, very quickly for this topic, but are not necessarily political bloggers themselves.
All right.
So is there any volunteer who wants to start? Maybe give an example of one political blog and what interests you.
I'm not a political blogger, but I read them. I guess maybe we should start off with definitional issues. We sort of included in our subject news blogs that have a political focus. They're not really blogs, I guess. They're just sort of collecting news stories with minimal commentary from around the blogosphere. And it also includes more traditional blogs, people who write, you know, their own opinions about politics in a chronological form. And I really like this blog called Wonkette, and I read it a lot. And they're claiming right now to have leaked the Foley story. So that's just an example of the sort of influence that they may or may not have. Again, like the Drudge Report may or may not have been the first mention of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, so that they are a significant source of news for a lot of people, and they seem to be able to get information out that either before other people or that might not have gotten out through traditional media sources. So I think that's part of why it's exciting. Let's hear from Andrew.
I'm going to carry your instructional device and say that if we look at it in terms of political, if you look at what's, we took a really broad view of both political and blog. So we listed some things that are maybe not necessarily political. They just happen to do with sort of, I guess, geopolitics instead of just politics, right? Because when people say political blogs, they think of things like Daily Kos and Walkett and Red State, but they're not, they're specifically domestic and American politically focused. But there are lots of ways in which blogs have become tools of grassroots political movements, and both actually tools for states to keep tabs on their citizens in repressive regimes, but also tools for people in repressive regimes to get out from under those regimes, to sort of, like, blogs have been equated to the First Amendment when no First Amendment exists in some countries. And then we also listed a few sites that aren't actually blogs, because the idea is that new media is new media. It's anything people create on the web to express a voice, to organize opinions, to coordinate activities.
I don't have too much to add, so I'll just make sure he doesn't fall and then keep talking. I think one kind of non-traditional use for blogs that I like to use them is, I don't really tab any and read them every day, but if there's an interesting news story that breaks, or kind of something that's going on, whether it's the elections now or, you know, just anything that happens, I think if you kind of Google the issue, you can find a ton of different takes on it, and it's just kind of interesting to expand the thought. And I think that's one thing that blogs have particularly been effective at. And then another thing is just, you know, you were saying setting up blogs as kind of this opposition to traditional media, but I think it's been really interesting to see how they've affected big media, you know, that we typically would equate with news, to the point where they're starting to address kind of the issues that bloggers bring up, and they're starting to, you know, talk about the effect that the blogs will have on the political discourse. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, particularly in 06. But, you know, maybe that's another interesting thing we can talk about, is just how it's kind of shifted the focus of the mainstream political media.
The only thing that I really have to add is, we also had kind of a focus on the way that blogs, well, it's kind of an expansion of what Andrew said about the First Amendment. It really gives a voice to anybody who wants to have one. And we thought about, or we've been discussing, whether that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, how that affects the discourse online or in the real world, because you don't necessarily have to be an expert on anything in order to have a blog. If you can just create enough buzz, like we talked about, then you get people listening to it, even if you're a crackpot. So that adds a voice to the dialogue that wasn't necessarily there, except for maybe in op-eds in major newspapers, but that still was controlled by big media. So,
you make it sound like that's a bad thing. Would you say that?
No, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think that I think it's good to have more voices. I mean, I think what blogs offer to us is really kind of a true marketplace of ideas. You get anybody being able to talk to anybody instantaneously, and so if it's a crazy crackpot idea, then it'll get shot down in the comment section, and maybe that blog won't be as popular anymore. And if another idea happens to rise to the fore, well, then that will become popular, and then that's when the media starts picking up on things like Andrew or Mary and Aaron were saying. So I think it could be good or bad. It's just something to discuss, I think.
So, Beck, I wonder, just to start and maybe take issue with how you framed it a little bit, and then to pick up on some of these things. Early on in introducing the whole blogs idea, you mentioned that they might be changing politics to some extent. And I'm not positive that that's actually happening. So I think that seems to me sort of the hypothesis that we have to test a bunch of things against. It seems clear from what each of these examples suggested that affecting the media environment is something that's happening. But I think we've got a long way to go between figuring out that blogs in the political context are just changing the media environment versus actually changing politics. It seems to me, in some ways, that's the hard trajectory to make. And if we're thinking about in terms of somebody who is seeking to make a rhetorical case in this information environment, how do we figure out what it is that, in fact, is useful about what you might do as a political blogger to make your case ultimately, and, in fact, ultimately to change change politics. It seems like you guys, go ahead.
I just want to frame the
Are you a political blogger? Are you on the panel?
Yes.
Oh, good. All right. You somehow got off without having to. Yeah.
Thank you. Just to frame your last question a slightly different way, what I was thinking while I was listening to you say that was, the proof, I guess, that blogs are everything that they're cracked up to be would be that
they are.
Well, before you get so confident in that.
No, I mean, no, that was a question for me.
If they are, though, if they really are, then why is it that politics in the traditional sense still exists? Or maybe I'm misunderstanding what politics is, but I think politics is the exploitation of a privileged mouthpiece. Mm-hmm. And if blogs are truly globalizing this idea so that everybody can have a voice, why is it that politics as usual can still exist?
I think it's a good question, but I'd certainly, my question is meant to amplify that set of inquiries rather than to cut it off. So I think more to be said on that score. But I wonder, can we just back up maybe for 1 second? You may have covered all of this, but I'd be really interested in what you've said or what this group is thinking about in terms of how we respond to information differently in this environment, in the sort of digital media environment, than we did before. So it seems like if we're talking about law in the court of public opinion, to some extent, think about it as the end users, the receptors of the information. So Mary's bloggers and these bloggers you've talked about are obviously trying to reach out to somebody. Let's presume that Wong Ket is after some voters, some style people, some like New York gossipy people, right? That's the end user community. But have you guys established in a way how it is different that we're receiving information or interacting with information than we were 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Is there a working hypothesis for that kicking around this class?
We've talked about it some in a variety of different guises, in terms of how people relate to the identity of the speaker through different technological media, and we've talked about it in a variety of ways, but I'd be very interested to know from the group, I think that this may be one of the first things where this is something that probably there's a bunch of you in here who actively read some of these political blogs and who also actively read traditional media like the New York Times. And it would be, this really is, that question is the topic of both this class and the next two classes. So I would like to just start off and
Can I ask
let's
it
find
a
out.
Little way, that, or slightly
yeah.
different than that?
Please
but,
do.
Which is, it seems to me that if you asked your dad's generation, how do you get news about politics or about the public sphere? You read the New York Times cover to cover while drinking a cup of coffee, or you listen to Dan Rather or one of these people at 6:30 or whatever the time nightly news was, right? That was kind of the story that you got. And maybe it was you chattered among your friends or you sat on the front porch wherever you might have been and you talk about it. But that there's sort of a there's a broadcast to you by somebody who's a newspaper or a commentator, and then you kind of talk locally amongst yourselves to some extent. Maybe you write letters and so forth. I'm curious what the current version of that is. If you're the voter or you are a receiver of information or participant in the information environment of today, what's the equivalent of reading the New York Times cover to cover? We've actually got reporters in the room, too. We've got people who can tell us the story from another angle as well. But what's the equivalent of watching the nightly news or reading the New York Times cover to cover in terms of learning about an election or something in the public sphere?
So for me, I listen to NPR on the radio. I go to the New York Times website, but I don't usually read the paper copy of it. Sometimes I look at Wikinews, and I read my husband's blog. So something very close to my own home. Somebody else?
Does Wayne blog about politics at all?
Yeah, he's got his pet subjects. Uh-huh. Israel-Lebanon conflict is a big one.
Uh-huh. I'm sure Ann Hubert has something to say about this.
I think the biggest thing that strikes me about the way you describe the way people used to get news versus the way I think we do now is that it's just so much more fragmented now. I'll read a couple stories in New York Times. Maybe I'll see something that I think has to do with a particular kind of political bent, and so I'll look at the Washington Post, or maybe I'll look at Wong Ket, or other sort of more targeted websites. But I'm not going to sit down and read an entire broadcast on a TV show or an entire newspaper. So it's just coming from so many different sources.
What's the longest article or MP3 or MOVE file or whatever that you will sustain, that you'll sit through?
It depends on the topic and on the day. I think on the weekend I'm more likely to click through and read six or seven pages of an article. Uh-huh. Otherwise,
is that like
the
New Yorker article length or a Salon.com kind of article length?
I won't claim to read a whole New Yorker article.
Got it. All right. So shorter than New Yorker article.
Yeah, helpful. More like a New York Times Magazine article.
Got it.
Yeah. During the week, though, I often won't even click through to the second
page. Not page two. Uh-huh. It's like the top 10 Google hits, then you don't go to, right?
Sad, but true. Right. Yeah, it's just you get distracted or move on to something else because of time.
Do you ever talk back?
No. Do I ever talk back? Do I post?
Comments,
I
posts,
haven't
blog.
Ever posted, actually.
No, okay.
No.
All right. Cool. And that's from a political pro, too, in fact, right?
So it seems like one of the biggest things is probably just the filtering. I mean, this is probably the same point, or a similar point at least. It's that now with news, you can filter it yourself so much more than you could before. When you sat down and read the New York Times front to back page, you went through and you would look, but you would have to find, actively search for those stories that interested you. Now with something like an RSS feed or with Google where you can search for news stories, it makes it so that you don't have to put that kind of time or commitment into it, and it makes it easier to find the stories you're interested in, and as a result, you can read, you know, six or seven stories, but they're all targeted. Those six and seven are all targeted at what you want to know, as opposed to reading six or seven broad stories that maybe only one was what you
really
wanted.
So do you use an RSS reader?
I do.
How many people here read their news in an RSS reader? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, that's not so many. So will you give us just, not everybody perhaps knows exactly what an RSS reader is and how it works. Will you give us just the two-second version of what that means?
Right. So an RSS feeder, basically, it stands for really simple syndication.
It does. And we host the specification here at Harvard Law School, in fact.
Yeah. So it basically updates, it gives you a list of the stories on a website. So let's say you subscribe to the RSS feed of the New York Times. It would lay out what the stories as they were posted, and they come out on your RSS feed and just list. So you can automatically click on the story that you want. Instead of actually having to go to the website and look at the stories, it just updates in your links.
So how many RSS feeds do you subscribe to?
Probably about 12.
Will you tell us a handful? Do you subscribe to the New York Times?
Yeah, the New York Times, LA Times, a couple techie blogs.
So do you subscribe to all of the New York Times, or do you subscribe to part of the New York Times?
Just part of it.
And so what do you subscribe to?
Within that, I think I subscribe to the politics section, and there's a U.S. news section as well.
And what about LA Times?
The LA Times, the local news section, just so I can get that. And then that's about
Interesting.
It.
Interesting. Who else? All right, one over here. How do you get your news?
Well, I'm a journalist, so I wish people could get it from the journalist, but I've seen that one of the big differences is that now people go to the source of the news, like they would read the blogs of the politicians, or they would also go to think tanks that get out the analysis. So like I get the news like that. I go to some think tanks that just have their own
So you
analysis.
Wake up in the morning and you open the web page of a think tank?
Well, not every day, but during elections, when there are elections going on, I do that because I think they have like the more sophisticated
analysis. What do you do
when you
wake up on an ordinary
day? Well, I read it from the New York Times.
But New York Times online, New York Times
online,
in paper?
Online.
And you just go to nytimes.com and you read. How much of it do you read?
Like the front page and I see
you
the international news.
You click through to every
news.
Story?
Well, not every story, but many of them, and the international page.
And you read anything else over the course of a day?
No.
No. David, will you do the same? Tell us how you get your news. And maybe about your background, too. Seems relevant.
Well, I read the New York Times in the paper form, but I read a lot of political blogs. But I also find that I still desire some synthesis and analysis that I evidently don't get because I try to watch the NewsHour most days with TiVo now. I can do that. And there's something about their way of presenting the news that I evidently don't find in other sources. So even though I agree that there's no longer a gatekeeper, there's no longer an editor who decides what stories I'm going to read by their decisions of what goes on the front page and what makes it in the paper. And there are lots of stories that don't make it in the paper every day. I've taken on that role because now I can go out and affirmatively look for those stories. I still find that there's a value to someone who is perhaps an expert in that area to tell me what are the important stories. And so in some ways I'm getting both, because I feel like I need to.
So do you have a theory on how you're in this business, or at least nominally have been in this business, right, of providing, you know a lot about the law and so forth, but you also know something about providing journalism. I'd be interested in your thoughts too. Do you have a theory on how people who are nominally in this room, in this generation, are in fact getting their information and processing information?
Well, I know they're not buying the newspaper as much anymore.
Right. Does anybody else buy the New York Times? One? Does anybody buy any other newspaper? That's bad news.
Yeah.
That's bad news for the newspaper business.
But, you know, readership of newspaper websites has gone way up.
Yep.
If you look at where most investigative journalism is happening, it's still happening in newspapers. Blogs tend to recycle a lot of the news. Most of the money and resources that goes into digging up stories, doing investigative pieces, doing enterprise journalism, that's still being done by newspapers. Television hasn't been doing that. So even though we're not buying the newspaper, we're relying on the value that newsrooms are providing to our society. You know, I think it'd be very interesting to look empirically at the stories that, you know, yes, Wonkette claims that they broke this story, but I think the Miami Herald first had those emails. They didn't write the story. I think they regret that. but a lot of what the blogs have taken and refined and dug deeper and scratched and made sense of, the legwork was done by newspaper journalists. So if newspapers become extinct, there's going to be a big hole there, and in that their resources aren't going to be available to do those kinds of stories.
So you're plainly saying newspapers shouldn't go extinct, and I suspect that most people would agree with you that despite the fact that only three people here or four actually pay for a newspaper through the ordinary means of paying for subscription, somehow there's something's going to survive of this. But where do you think it's headed in terms of what's sort of crystallizing among all of us in terms of how we get it? So you've developed the value that newspapers might provide. But you know, if you maybe put yourself back in the mode of a communicator, someone who's trying to make this case, how would you reach out to and get to somebody like Mary Weld?
I'm not sure I'm necessarily wedded to the idea that the newspaper has to print a physical paper and get it. I think as long as the attributes that make up good journalism are translated to these other mediums, for example, blogs and whatnot, then those important parts that our society gets from journalism are gonna live on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not wedded to what looks more and more like an antiquated medium of communication, which is a physical newspaper. I think the challenge is to find a financial model that supports the kind of journalism that newspapers do on this new medium, where advertising doesn't pay the same as it does in print newspapers. I mean, right now I would guess, other than the few people in here who may subscribe to the Wall Street Journal's paid section, we're getting our news for free online. And this class is a lot about alternatives to sort of the normal commercial distribution of information. And that's great, but that isn't going to pay a journalist's salary, and that isn't going to provide the kind of support for a team of investigators to go for 2 or 3 years looking into an issue. You know, Jay Rosen's new assignment.net is an excellent idea of trying to bridge that gap, but that to me is where the challenge is how do we take the characteristics that make up good journalism, translate them to the web, and do it in a way that's financially viable.
Hmm. Given the clacking on the keyboards, I suspect a lot of people are getting some free news right now, or else there are a lot of notes being taken. Charlie, you were going to, or Professor Nesson, jump in.
I think this microphone.
How about this one?
Slightly.
Oh, you're being picked
yeah,
up.
You come over and hold it, okay?
Right,
I don't want to get my hands all over.
David, I want to ask you a question. When I read newspapers, what has struck me as I've gotten older is how the stories are all the same. That is, there are placeholders. And yes, you fill them with today's fear story or today's bit from... And if I turn it around the other way, the newspapers look like a platform for the dissemination of whatever our governments are wanting us to hear to a very large extent. I mean, Bush is constantly on the front page, always pictures. His key people are always being covered. It's basically following the story of our government. Now, if the newspapers didn't exist, I have a sense our government would somehow need to have their story told and would find a way to do it. What can you turn it around? That is, look at it not from the point of view of the plight of the poor readers who now have to rely on blogs and don't have the real repertorial skill of, you know, young people that go into journalism and beat themselves up finding stories. But look at it from the point of view of the power interests that actually rely on controlling the rhetorical environment to a very substantial extent. What do you see as the effect there from the decline of the news media or the potential decline of the structured newsroom, the directed, capitalist-directed newsroom?
You want to answer that?
I'm not sure I can easily answer that. You raise a lot of good points. I think it's clear, even if you don't look at the effect perhaps the internet is having, there's always an interest on the part of public officials to communicate their message directly to voters, because they can control the message that way. I mean, this administration has been very good at that. But that's not just the Bush administration plan. That's been people in power for probably forever. We're in a transition period now where it's in some ways a free-for-all. And as a reader of news through the internet, one of the, and I'll say it's a benefit, I'm not sure that's the right word, and the way you characterize it, maybe it's not. One of the benefits to newspapers is there's some credibility there. There's some belief when I read a story in the newspaper that the facts are right, that it's been checked, that there's an effort at objectivity, and those are all things that people can debate. But there is this sort of credibility that comes with it that on the internet maybe hasn't been established yet. And for example, we talked about AstroTurf in one of our previous classes. You know, one of the side effects to open participation and having anyone be able to produce news is that AstroTurf organizations can take on the mantle of being, promoting the public interest when, in fact, what they're really doing is promoting some corporate interest. How do we deal with that? How do I know as a reader whether or not what I'm reading is believable or not? And I think that's one of the things you lose when we go to a system that, as you described, where we're allowing this sort of direct one-to-one, many-to-one, many-to-many communication. So there are, you know, good and bad things that come out of it, but I think we're in a transition period and trying to work that out.
So Rebecca has something she'd like to say.
Yeah, I just want to say that this question of the credibility of the news media is an extremely interesting question, and it is the topic of Tuesday's class next week. We're actually going to focus on the whole concept of fake news and the relationship of fake news to real news. That question merits a whole day of discussion. Maybe we can earmark it for then.
The Berkman Center, which Charlie founded about 2 years ago, as this whole bloggers and mainstream media discussion was just heating up, convened 40 people on this question of credibility online. Half of them were from the mainstream media, so included the managing director of the New York Times and so forth, and then half of them were the Jay Rosens and the blogger types. And this was clearly the flashpoint, this question of credibility. Did the mainstream media have more credibility or a better track record of establishing credibility, or in fact did the bloggers have that? And the bloggers, of course, claim not credibility so much as they claimed authenticity, something slightly different. But I do think that that's the core issue that, you know, this will turn on. Is it okay if I try out a theory, though, in terms of how people get news that might then help get toward maybe a bad theory, so you can shoot holes in the theory. But then getting back to the question of how you might use blogs or whatever else you might put online, user-generated content, in fact, to change politics. Here's a theory, and definitely shoot it down, because this is a guess. But just thinking about what the crowd of those of us who were born, I don't know, sometime before or after 1970, put it that way, sort of a crowd of digital natives, put it in those terms. Maybe Becca and I are people who learned to become digital as opposed to born digital, but people who are sort of in this room and are maybe slightly younger than Charlie, rather than the New York Times model, I won't even mention Nathan back there. Here's the idea. So the first step would be grazing. That the first thing we do is you go to an RSS reader, or you go to My Yahoo, or you go to Google News or Wiki News, and you get a series of headlines. And you actually, it could be the New York Times front page, but some aggregator, basically just of headlines, and that you get this very quick snapshot of what the news of the day is. Maybe it is a think tank. You know, if a think tank actually itself were an aggregator of other ideas, but it's basically the headline move, right? And you see this grazing over the course of the day. So anybody who uses My Yahoo might have it as your homepage. You might or might not click through. But then there's a second phase, and this is call this a deep dive. And the deep dive is to say, okay, so in the grazing mode, you see, you know, 100 headlines over the course of a day, or 100 sort of short phrases. And on some subset of those, you decide, okay, I'm really interested in this. So this is Anne on the weekend saying, I'm going to read a New York Times story in the magazine cover to cover, so forth. It might be hard copy. It might be online. It doesn't really matter. But with two aspects to what the deep dive might be, it goes sort of to David's point. One is you do it because you want analysis. Right. So in fact, what you're after is I want to get what somebody I trust had to say about it, or at least somebody whose analysis of it strikes me as potentially of interest. Or the other idea is you want it for opinion. So it's an op-ed, or it's a blogger, or it's somebody who is going to take a slant on it that you might or might not agree with. Right. And then the third one, this is the Nessun theory here, is the feedback loop. And this is one that not so many people in this crowd have mentioned, but that I think is sort of increasingly part of the story, is at least, so the maximum things you do is you graze. You do fewer deep dives. You go read somebody else's opinion or analysis, and then fewest times. But the things you care most about, you then want to talk back to. So it might be that you click on a poll on the CNN.com website. It might be that you call a reporter back. It might be that you blog at your own blog. It might be you put a comment in a blog. It might be you create a podcast about it and you put that back out into the stream. But the notion is basically that it's the participatory side of the participatory media. And I would argue that mostly the blogs that are out there are doing the feedback, that ultimately most stories aren't broken, though some are. So the argument would be most of the grazing, the identification of the fact into the public sphere is usually done by a mainstream media organization. Not always, but let's just say 90-something percent of the time. Very occasionally, a citizen right now, in fact, breaks a story. It does some, the blog space does some of the deep dive, in the sense that you write a blog post that's your opinion about what the New York Times wrote that morning, or you analyze it from a slant that you have. So one of the comments that our blogging crowd said was, you introduce expert opinion. Charlie Nessun knows more about the law of evidence than, you know, 99.999999% of the people in the population. A new Supreme Court opinion comes down on something related to the law of evidence, and he writes the analytical piece that then everybody goes to rather than what the New York Times might say about it. But that most of what blogs and podcasts and wikis and vlogs are doing is the feedback loop. This is the chatter. It's the context around it that is picking up on the stories broken here. And then the investigatory work that the mainstream media is doing. So is that?
Let me just, for the sake of argument, yeah, accept this version of things.
Stipulated.
And which I think, you know, it sounds basically right to me, and tell you the sort of dark view of, yeah, the political world that I have at the moment and how it fits into here. So it seems to me, looking at what's going on now, take the Foley scandal as just an instance of it, that this graze method of reading the newspaper causes us to be drawn to these particularly sort of lurid glee in people's downfall types of stories. So something like the waterboarding video that we saw yesterday, a demonstration of the waterboarding torture technique that was really very difficult to watch, just doesn't have that kind of a quality for us, because there's no fun in watching, you know, some
person go down the tubes the way Foley is going to in this instance with his scandal. So the grays seems to me to sort of take our attention maybe away from some of the things, not to say that it's not important whether somebody is having a relationship with some other person on Capitol Hill, but it takes our attention away sometimes from some of the issues that really seem to be part of the conversation that we need to have to figure out how our government should operate. None of us disagree that this kind of behavior that Foley is engaging in should not be occurring, but there is a serious conversation to be had about whether waterboarding is an appropriate technique or not. And the blogs, whether they're breaking that or not, seem to me to be doing something in this feedback mechanism in which they actually are taking the time to pick out some of the other stories and attempt to raise them mm-hmm. back up to the level of getting the attention of people. Mm-hmm. I frequently find that the stuff that I think is important that just doesn't get coverage in these template big news media outlets ends up coming back up to the news through the blog sphere. So the feedback seems to me to be doing something pretty useful.
This is not a normative argument. This is the descriptive, positive one.
It's descriptive.
Right?
I guess it's normative. It's my argument for how the blogs are contributing to our discussion. And I don't think they're succeeding at the moment because we seem to still be totally focused on things like Lewinsky and Foley and not so much on the stuff that's coming up out of the blogs. But
is this right?
Yeah. Good. Sparking some conversation.
I want to quibble with that a little bit. I think it is happening. I mean, you definitely get more volume of stuff written and more people having a say about a wider variety of issues and probably, therefore, you know, more important issues or what issues you might find, like waterboarding, the things that, you know, wouldn't get a lot of talk necessarily. But I think that seems to me almost a sort of side effect of the fact that everything's just getting more coverage, and I'm sure that there's a lot more blogging going on about Foley than there is about waterboarding. And, you know, and perhaps even having this feedback loop would or does emphasize that. I mean, you get more coverage of the more lurid stuff because everybody's talking about it, and then they're talking to each other talking about it over and over and over again. Whereas at some point, you know, the New York Times editor says, look, there's nothing new happening in the Foley story, and let's talk about something else. So I'm not sure that I necessarily buy that feedback, you know, brings to the fore things that otherwise wouldn't have been. And I worry that maybe when you have so many people talking so passionately about everything, that the same things that tend to get everybody going, get them going.
Following up on that same sort of point, I'm not sure if the sort of blog, media, internet sorts of stories are really providing, you know, if you're saying you want to get out of the, you know, the Foley model, I don't know if they have or ever really were sort of providing sort of that punch to the media. If you certainly look at, you know, the way a blog works is that, you know, look at either sort of the original aggregator, Drudge, I think probably the original major aggregator. I mean, that it's the sensational story. It's like, that's where I go if I want the latest scandal, an earthquake, or some strange story involving animals. Like, these are like the three things that show up there all the time. And, you know, whether it's Drudge or whether it's Wonkette or whether it's, you know, the New York Times, I mean, they, even if they're not doing it for profit, which all those enterprises are, but I mean, even if I'm just a blogger not going for profit, is that I want eyeballs and I want people to like what I read. And, like and that sort of is just going to drive me to what the people want, and sort of the people want Foley, they don't want waterboarding, and I don't think that blogs really are really changing that dynamic of people will deliver and what will be popular is what people want. And I'm not sure if that's really going to change that dynamic.
So I pass the mic back over here. And I guess that's the question for us. I mean, we have asked you guys to pick something you're passionate about to choose to do for your projects. And it may be something that really takes some persuasion to get people to want to read it. It's not necessarily going to be something like the Foley scandal. And it's a question, can we find some way that we can make people want to pay attention to something that is more serious than just some lurid story? Is there any example of that succeeding that anybody knows of?
Well, right now I'm looking at Reddit.com, which is my favorite way of getting the news because I'm a really bad person. And instead of reading newspapers or political blogs, I just read what other people find interesting. And usually that I find that leads me to a pretty good like coverage of the news. And yes, like he said, there are stories about funny animals and whatever. But there's also, you know, this news about a self-assembling gel that stops bleeding. And that's the number one story. It's not
Mark
Foley.
Sorry, repeat what that story
was
in?
A self-assembling gel that stops bleeding in seconds. So a biotech invention. That's the number one story right now. Foley's not even on the front page. And Foley is on the front page in the New York Times. So I think like the difference is that with a lot of these news aggregators or blogs, the people running them are not necessarily only interested in politics. And they're not necessarily, they're very curious and they're probably ADD because they've been spending so much time on the internet. So like after 5 minutes of Foley, they're like, well, now we need to talk about how Google's buying YouTube or whatever. So I really do think that there is a difference because I do find that like on the Crimson or you know the New York Times or whatever, it is the same like stories over and over again. Whereas with the internet, it changes much faster.
Somebody over here had a hand up.
The other day, they were telling me that the LeMonde.com, the French newspaper online, found out that most of the readers now were starting to read the news by the comments. So they started reading the comments, and if the comments were really juicy, they would go up and read the news. And I think that's kind of a trend that we should be kind of aware, because I think that is starting to happen a lot, and I'm not sure where that fits.
Well, that's starting with the feedback, right? It's starting to say that's what interests you most. The other thing you might do to layer onto this theory to pick up on these last two comments is to think about the role of sort of the social network and social news, obviously. So Reddit.com is one example of something like Dig. Do people read Dig? D-I-G-G, which is you get to identify a story and you say up or down, basically, and you're tagging stories. And Reddit and Dig both float up to the top of this massive public aggregator, the things that the most people dig, right? So there's a social complement to you should graze or you at least should see this thing that everybody else says is important. That's a variant of the same thing of just looking where the comments are and that then will lead you to read that story. So I think there's definitely kind of a social software overlay that brings the feedback loop up back to the grazing effectively. So that it's once people have seen stuff, they're identifying what they think other people should graze, and then hopefully that's virtuous, but I think there are lots of theories that say it's not.
I'm really curious. I like this model here. All right. I think it really shows the many benefits why people go to places like the internet for news. I'm wondering how the phenomenon then of television is still so popular when through TV you don't have control over any of these things.
Mm-hmm. Someone's got to have an answer to that.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of this discussion we're having, I think the TV thing relates to it, is one of the kind of fundamental questions is why are people reading, you know, a particular news story or news in general? Are you reading it, you know, to get some, you know, almost out of duty to feel that you, you know, basically know what's going on in the world, you know, as an informed citizen of a democracy.
Like eating your broccoli. Not spinach, yeah. Of course, at the moment. But right.
Or are you reading it for entertainment?
No.
And, you know, if you're reading it for the first reason, you're probably going to be, you know, most interested in, you know, North Korea's missile test and, you know, kind of big hard news stories like that. And if you're interested on the other side, you know, you're it's more human interest or...
There's disdain,
you know, things
in your voice about that North Korean missile test.
Oh, right. I know nothing about the North Korean missile test. You know, and then you have these stories, you know, like the Foley thing, which is, you know, somewhere in between. It's like, A, an important political story that will affect the elections, and B, it's kind of a, you know, morality story of a perv on Capitol Hill. And... you know, with the blogs, I think there's a lot of it gets kind of contributes to a news as entertainment kind of thing. You know, you read these stories, you know, you're a lot of it getting for, you know, the person's voice. You know, we talked about authenticity as opposed to credibility. But I think if you really want credibility and are not interested in the person, you're probably going to want to look to an expert in a lot of senses, someone who you view as an expert and authoritative. And I think that's where, you know, A, helps mainstream media stay alive, and B, I think, you know, that's, and that kind of contributes to why TV is important, is because, you know, someone thinks, I don't have the time or the wherewithal to know what are the really important stories. I trust a bureau of people whose job it is to do this.
Mm-hmm. Two people here.
I just wanted to throw up another thing that is troubling, I guess, and this is building off of that. And it's that I think that at the Grays level, with more and more people being able to choose sort of where they turn first for their grazing, that's already, you know, coloring all the lower levels pretty significantly. So, you know, not surprisingly, we've talked about the New York Times as being a sort of high-level graze site where people might go. But I think, you know, a different group of people might pick Fox News as the high-level graze site where they would go. And that's already a fairly, I mean, that makes a choice about which stories you're going to be able to follow up, and you've already decided that. So you're already kind of narrowing things down a bit. You know, and RSSs do that as well. I mean, you subscribe. It's like subscribing to a magazine or whatever, and you know, pick the stuff that you think is going to be interesting to you. Unless you have a real strong sort of sense of social duty, and I should know about everything that's going on from the most objective places possible, I think a lot of people are going to make those initial choices based on, you know, entertainment or looking for things that they already agree with.
Mm-hmm. So we should come back to that just down here. But
pass the mic here, then we're going to have to take a break to switch the tape.
Can I just leave a footnote really fast?
You can leave a footnote right after.
Okay, after Christine. Sorry.
Okay. Well, my response to that is just that, yes, that's true, and it's also still true for TV because the examples that we just used are applicable. But the difference between TV and, like, maybe FoxNews.com or a similar news site is that people can comment back on the news sites. And especially on the internet where everyone loves to argue, like, inevitably some liberal person is going to show up on FoxNews.com and be like, this article is completely wrong. And then you're like, hey, this article could be completely wrong. Maybe I'll go and see what this guy has to say. So I feel like, yes, that's true, and that's always going to be true, but at least there's this, like, I feel like the collective voice of a blog is more maybe accurate than any expert because there's so many eyes looking at it.
You can do a footnote, or we can cut tape. All right, so we'll just take a tape break for just 1 minute for Tim to change the tape.
Just like an orientation thing of, are you creating it or are you, you know, consuming it? But I think very often you're going to be reading those things or giving other people things in the feedback.
So. Are you okay with, you're recording directly to a drive, you don't have a tape? Well, I have two things I want to get to. I would like to discuss the issue of trust and how that is established, the difference between trusting a bureau, trusting an individual, trusting an aggregator.
That's the credibility stuff, too, that you should try to do.
And credibility, authenticity, and hype. We haven't really heard anybody, except for me, reading my husband's blog, saying that they trust an individual.
Individual, right. Yeah.
Which is interesting to me. I was expecting that. And then I would like to actually try to get a couple of examples of projects from students and talk about how to make it actually work. You know, how are you going to get?
And then maybe right to end.
That would be perfect. Okay, so let's bring it back together. So I just want to start us off again by picking up on the threads of credibility, authenticity, and trust that keep coming up in this discussion. We have heard about different types of news sources and how we establish a sense of trust in them and what we're looking for. And so in particular, we've heard about news bureaus as one source of news that you might trust, a bureau of experts of some sort. You might trust an aggregator like Reddit in order to get sort of the democratic view of what's important, or you might trust an individual, and so far the only examples that we've seen of that are so far, I think it's just me trusting my own husband's blog. So that's very close to me. I mean, maybe it's unusual for people to trust an individual. Mary likes Wonkette, but that's they. That's some group of people rather than a single person, perhaps. So these are the different models that we're working with. And I just would like to open it up and ask, what makes a particular type of organization trustworthy to you? What would make you want to read from some organization or individual? I don't know where the mic went. Oh, it's back there. Could you pass it to your right? Or, yeah.
I guess I should preface this by saying that I'm Jonathan Zittrain's research assistant, and I have him on iChat from Oxford. And he, I just wrote this comment that about how so many people are looking at newspaper articles by the comments, or looking at the comments first. And he wrote, big AstroTurf opportunity. And I just wanted to throw that into the mix about trust, where a PR firm or a group of people could get together and write comments on everything and kind of skew this whole question of the democratic view of looking at news. So,
we pass the mic down front here.
Thanks. It's also true, I think, that people tend to trust what they agree with. And I think one thing that's been pointed out is that people, the blogosphere is also, it's this great democratic thing, but I think it's also really polarizing because people are going, there's such, you can so easily self-select. And so for me, I know, like, I'll read something and I'll start nodding and think, yeah, this guy's really credible, because I already have the same thoughts, and so it's not challenging me the same way that a paper might that has to sort of serve a broader array of interests.
So let me push you just a little bit on that. This is something that I don't actually read a lot of individual blogs for this reason, that I start to feel like I'm getting one side of some story, like on the Israel-Lebanon, it's like I'm reading the Chomsky blog or I'm reading the Dershowitz blog, and it's usually one or the other. I don't get a clear sense of it. And so I'm wondering, when that's happening to you and you're sitting there nodding, or when you're watching The Daily Show and you agree with everything that Jon Stewart is doing or something like that, how do you deal with that? What do you do at that point when you've recognized, wait a minute, maybe I'm just getting one side? You, anybody, whoever has
I read individual posts usually just for a narrative, for a sense of a story, instead of some journalist seeking out someone's story and glorifying it and maybe making up parts of it. This is someone's life. Like, there was no good way to get a sense of what was going on in Lebanon or going on in Haifa. I mean, the best way, for me anyway, was going to people's posts, and there were people who had put up videos of, this is what's happening in my town today, and that was fascinating, and it had nothing to do, it wasn't an argument, so I didn't fall into that trap. But the nice thing about the web, too, is that when you find yourself falling into that trap, you can quickly check whether what they're saying is right or not. There's so many ways to simply create a new browser and check on Wikipedia or whoever, you know?
So I'd like to throw that one to David now, just because that raises the question of citizen journalism in the most basic sense, that one of the things that we are relying on the big media for is to send reporters out to different areas of the world to tell us what's happening there. But when people can just take a video in their hometown and post it on their blog, maybe without any opinion, could that not be serving that purpose?
It's a broad continuum of the way journalists function, and it's a situation where the analysis, and as we were talking about this, I'm thinking through what it means to what truth is. What do we, when we talk about the objective facts, what do we mean when we say that? And the Necker Cube is an example of that. That we could have three different perspectives, all of which are absolutely right, all of which are factually accurate, all of which are objective. But you can't see all three perspectives at the exact same time. So part of a journalism's aim is to present those perspectives in the most transparent fashion possible, in the most complete fashion and with the context so that the reader, so that the recipient of the information can make their own assessment as to what the factual validity is of what they're seeing. And
so from my personal perspective, what would you recommend would be the best way for me to get to see those three perspectives? Would it be to go to a news bureau source, to go graze around a bunch of blogs that have disagreeing points of view? What kind of a thing? We go to Reddit?
Probably all of those things. You know, the way the human mind works, the more information that you can have and the more skeptical you are and the more questions you ask, probably in the end, the better you're going to be at interpreting the world around you.
Oh, let me get the mic.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like another try at it. I feel that the same thing that is true individually is also in many ways true collectively, that there's a self-similarity at scale. When you see the Dershowitz-Chomsky dichotomy of different ways to see the world, and you see that played out in so many ways at an institutional level, it seems to me it reflects the same thing that's true at a personal level, which I believe to be that each one of us in some way requires the people that love us to maintain fictions about ourselves to us. That is, the idea of the truth that you can't handle. It's like we saw yesterday with Jason's amazing little video argument that there are truths that we don't want to handle, we don't want to see. And so the media is largely structured to give us what makes us comfortable and keeps us coming back. So in many ways, the idea of what's credible and what's not credible seems like the best approach is to turn it around. Something's about to blow up.
It's you, I think.
Uh-huh.
It's one of those truths that you can't quite handle.
Yeah. I think of it much more like poker. That the name of the game at poker is to assume that all the information you're getting is being given to you for you to figure out. But you have to be the judge of all of it. There's many signals coming through that are trying to send you messages. And the real read that you're trying to get to is the under message all the time. It's like you're trying to read the thought that's not being expressed or the thought that's doubly expressed. So in many ways, it seems to me that this idea of credibility assumes a kind of passive role for us as listeners. You know, who are we to believe? It's in many ways, to me, the challenge becomes a much more active one of who are we to decide that we will believe? And it's not a matter of just picking it out. It's a matter of reading the signals in a quite broad way. To me, the thing that is most exciting about the blog space in general in relationship to politics is that so long politics has been a process of controlling the rhetorical environments with one device or another. And those means of control are clearly breaking up. Whether they're totally disintegrating, that's another question altogether. But it is clear that it's becoming harder and harder for people in power to control their information spaces.
It seems to me like that's true. You can't control the information space, but for the most part, we all act like a bunch of sheep in that regard, where we don't want to hear the truths that we don't want to hear, and we're more than happy to just not be the good poker player in the news reading situation.
Absolutely right. I mean, but you're in a sense, you're talking about the herd instinct of tribes of human beings who build rhetorical environments in which they resonate with each other and define themselves as different from other tribes with different rhetorical spaces. And our tribe has its news media, and we produce it, and we're probably replicating it to a large extent in the blog space. The thing that starts to be exciting, though, is things like Global Voices, which starts to mix the spaces, and the idea that small worlds can connect and different spaces can actually link in the environment to produce a much more fluid information space. Somehow working in that direction seems like the way to go, it's the way it is going. It's not even a question of we're going to decide to do this. This is just happening. To me, the interesting questions are how you can advocate within this environment in ways that are effective. How seeing the structure of the space changing, can you become an actor in a way that allows you to advance whatever it is that you take as your cause?
So talk a little bit about Al Gore.
Well, Al Gore. I'd be delighted to talk about Al Gore. Here's a guy that, to me, exhibits what I think of as a cyber strategy. When you think of the net, it's global. But how many people are there in the world who are speaking to a global audience? Very few. Very few choose to address the problems of the globe to the globe. So Gore has the thought, he's going to do that. He cares about the environment. So he makes an argument using digital media, basically putting together a slideshow and filming it and cutting it nicely and putting it out. And that's the advance of a big argument. I would wish that it was more effective than it has been. I'd love to figure out ways to make it more effective. But at least I think of Gore as somebody who's thinking about how to put out the argument he wants to advance in a way that it could possibly be taken up by some kind of a global audience and feedback in some way that would make a difference.
Did you have your hand up? Or?
Well, I think one of the toughest things about it is that, you know, whether it's from the mainstream media or from blogs and independent media, people have, you know, what's a hard truth to handle for some people might be easy to handle for others and vice versa, and there's still, you know, that kind of high-level grazing. Like, we've talked about the waterboarding video a number of times, but I think, you know, how hard a truth it is to handle depends on kind of where you're coming from. If you're someone who, and I'm not even going to venture my personal opinions here one way or another, but if you're somebody who believes that U.S. military intervention in Iraq and other places is a fundamentally good and constructive thing, and you know, the war on terror is very important, et cetera, then it's going to be a hard truth for you to handle that this is something that goes on during it. If you're someone who feels that all of that is, you know, bad, then, you know, it might be at some level disturbing to watch someone being waterboarded, but it also has like an element of vindication. It's like, you know, I knew our military is doing bad things there. This is proof. This actually, in a perverse way, you know, at a second level, kind of makes me feel good to watch this. So I think that, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's, you know, kind of that tribe mentality or following what you already know to believe to be, already believe to be true is, you know, working at all, you know, both the mainstream and alternative and alternatives to alternatives spaces.
Somebody in the back want to pick up on it?
I was just going to suggest that we've raised a lot of interesting questions about how people read their news and why they read certain news and what they're able to understand and synthesize. And it seems to me that there are really powerful empirical tools in cognitive and social psychology that can be applied to these questions. And whoever figures out and does the experiment, you know, what kind of intermittent reward psychology is going on when people post feedback and then get a response on these sites, or how they choose to filter what they're reading, that is really going to determine who wins the rhetorical argument in these contexts. And that you could I would imagine, based on psychology, really pinpoint certain strategies that would really work in getting people to read and assimilate what you want.
So we haven't got that at our disposal, but in a basic sense, it seems to be sort of saying if somebody could figure out what are the truths we can't handle ourselves, then that would be really helpful, or what sort of thing is attractive to people.
Yeah, and I'm saying I think they can figure it out. Like, for example, with the lurid story, that seems like a timeless issue that people are drawn to: sex, scandal, drama, violence, mystery, certain things over, you know, bureaucratic excess or things that make a government they identify with look bad, for instance.
So let's, for the last 20 minutes of class, get concrete with this. I want to think about how you guys are going to do this with your projects. I don't know whether a blog or some kind of text-based internet medium is what people are going to choose or how political your particular topics are, but this is the problem that faces you. And we've had a fairly cynical view here of what the audience is like and what sort of ways things will attract them and how you can attract them. So if there's somebody here who would be willing to venture what they've chosen as their project, and just let us sort of workshop it together and see how you could imagine getting people to become interested in it, that's what I would like to do. And if we can't find somebody brave enough to do that, then I'd like to use Al Gore as our guinea pig instead and try to actually get at the question of what would need to happen in his campaign for it to create real political change, not just a change in the media environment, but serious change in the way that the people around the globe relate to the environment.
Well, I don't mean to be obstreperous, but as an alternative to Al Gore, I would myself love to know how we could persuade Comcast to allow us to have a guide that would allow people to have access to excellent content in community television, which is the essence of what community television needs to become powerful enough to protect itself and develop in the world. That seems to me closer to home than Al Gore, but I'm a lover of Al Gore too, so.
All right, and let's see. Let's see if there is anybody in here who would like to have the opportunity to have everyone think about their project and focus attention on how you might get it off the ground.
I have one, but how long are we going to take before?
Well, we've got basically 15 minutes left of class to discuss any one of these three issues, whatever people have ideas about.
Say 5 minutes for feedback.
Oh, and we have feedback memos, so we have 10 minutes to discuss this.
So, at the beginning of the summer, I started...
Wait, hang on just 1 minute. We'll get you the microphone. There you go.
9 minutes left. I started working with a guy who's collecting soldier testimonies from various military engagements, and his idea is that there's absolutely no connection between people who are advocating for human rights generally as this broad concept and people who are advocating for military interventions or actions. And generally that splits into sort of activists and state agents. And the two communities there's no link between the two communities. People aren't talking to each other. So this guy decided, let's, instead of simply running up to victims, people who've just been harmed, and saying, who hurt you, what happened, tell me your story, let's let's look at both sides of the story and ask people how they get in a situation where someone is getting hurt. And so the idea is collecting soldiers' testimony in various engagements about what is a soldier's experience, what's going through a soldier's mind when they do X, Y, or Z. And there are lots of questions about how best to do that. It would be so easy to set up something that for someone, this guy works at Human Rights Watch, it would be pretty easy to set up a website that completely vilifies soldiers, and that would be really useless and totally defeat the purpose of this project. So the question is, how do you have credibility with both the community that is mad at the military for various things and also the community that supports the military or the military themselves? How do you gain credibility with the military if you're trying to collect testimony from soldiers about their experience? And then how do you take what you get and make it useful to to all parties interested.
Do you have any ideas about that to start off with?
I do, yeah, a little bit. I mean, so what he's done mostly is to look at Israel and Palestine and interview soldiers, Israeli soldiers that were involved in Palestine, and ask them what was going through their head. Give us a sense of your story. And he found that a lot of them were really eager to talk because no one had ever asked them what it was like to be involved in a military engagement. And the stories were really interesting, and a lot of people who read them, he posted them on this website and had this conference, and a lot of people who read them found them really enlightening and had a totally different take on... the human rights activists in Israel had a totally different take on the military after reading the posts. And I think there were bridges built. This actually new NGO was born, I think, of that was going to try to establish a link between civil society and the military in Israel. So his point was just, if we tell stories, if we do something to bridge the divide between the two groups, we'll get somewhere. And so the idea of this, there's a website called Soldier Testimony. .org that collects, it's meant to just interview soldiers and collect stories, but the idea would be that you would have any form of storytelling on the website. So not just interviewing soldiers after a military intervention, but also soldier life, give soldiers a voice no matter what the media. So collect soldier blogs, have photographs from soldier experiences, videos, narratives, even fictional narratives.
All right, so we've got three ideas, and the question then for all of us is, what are we going to do to engage people in the ideas, to draw them into thinking about those ideas and then potentially persuading them to some perspective on it?
Well, it sounds like we've got three very different kinds of projects going on here. I mean, this last one is not as explicitly advocating for a particular position. It's more like, you know, an ongoing dialogue would be useful. The Comcast one is very, you know, is very focused. The audience for it is very clear, and maybe influencing public opinion. Like, if you could, you know, create an outrage in Cambridge or something, might get Comcast to want to do it. But probably the real advocating we're going to be doing would be, you know, trying to convince executives at Comcast or something like that. And then the Al Gore one, of course, is the perfect example of trying to convince everybody in the world, because you want to get sort of as much political change to happen as possible, and you want to do that by convincing a large group of people. And I think that you know, there are different audiences for these, and some might be more, or some might be better served by the kinds of strategies we're talking about, for instance, you know, even like influencing the comments on news things and stuff. I mean, that's the kind of thing that might really work well for creating a grassroots or a pseudo-grassroots belief in combating global warming or something. But probably, you know, you're not going to have a lot of news articles or really need to convince a lot of people to try and get Comcast to change stuff. So I'm not sure, you know, you have to think about which of these, I guess, media or which ways of internet things are tailored best to the particular kinds of arguments you're trying to make.
So give us one idea for one of the issues of how you would pursue it.
It seems like perhaps for the last one, that's the kind of thing that might be really might be best served by going to these different camps, right? The people who are talking about human rights and people who are talking about troop experiences and things, and really just kind of trying to link them over by saying, you know, hey, why don't you look at this? Here's something on the other side, you know, that kind of thing. Trying to sort of create those connections in a quasi-grassroots kind of way, either through comments or just actual trying, you know, putting linkings on stuff that allows that to happen. So that seems like the kind of thing that might work in that situation. Whereas I can't think of any for the Comcast example.
Anybody have thoughts about that or an idea for one of the other issues? Keep in mind that you will all be attempting to do this for your own projects.
Can I respond actually to Charlie's suggestion?
Yeah, let's just gaze around for one instant more to see if anyone wants to participate. Okay, so.
It is ultimately, hopefully, responsive. But it seemed to me that the refinement that your dad made was to say the interesting question is, how can you advocate in this space? And it seems to me that's, you sort of have to understand it first, but then to figure out what it is. And it seems like this is sort of a consultant-y way to answer the question, but I think it depends a ton on what the audience is that you're trying to get to and what context in which you're trying to play. So one of the things that I think is true of lots of these rhetorical questions with respect to internet is the environment is really, really different in lots of different contexts. So one way it's different is it the United States, where you've got a very developed mainstream media, but you've also got all these different voices and political actors and entrenched parties and so forth? Is it a developing country context, which is, you know, wholly different, right? Is it the whole world? You're trying to be Al Gore and reach everybody about global warming in some fashion. Another sort of slant on it is, what's your political aim, right? So is it actually as part of a campaign, you're trying to get somebody elected or some topic achieved or some issue passed or put on a ballot? Or is it more sort of awareness raising, or it's a feedback loop, or it's something else that you want to create? Charlie mentioned Global Voices. This is a project started at the Berkman Center that just won the Knight Batten Award for Innovations in Journalism as the grand prize of all things in the world for new media. What does it do? It's an aggregator solely of things that are being said in 100 different countries around the world. That is successful because it speaks to a very specific set of people looking for specific bits of information, but it doesn't achieve some overt political aim. And then I think that the last question is really the normative one, kind of Becca's question, which is, as you do this, is it ultimately going to have a good outcome for the world? Is it, in fact, that you're going to reinforce this problem that we only listen to the same voices that we ordinarily hear, or this is the Cass Sunstein Daily Me argument that sort of captures most of the internet and politics debate. So are you just speaking through these stories only to people who otherwise would have heard this, and you're just narrow casting it further and further down? And I think those three kind of sets of questions determine which of the media do you want to reach out to people with? And the only other thing on that score is video is obviously hot right now. So you've got video cameras going all over here. YouTube gets bought by Google for whatever, $1.6 billion. It seems like if you were in the soldier testimony zone or in the CCTV zone, why do you need the television networks right now? I mean, it seems like if there's ever been a chance to be able to disintermediate, to create new intermediaries, this seems to me the moment in which to do it and to be in step with that that overall trend. Now, of course, that's sort of a techie bleeding edge kind of way to see it. Lots of people still watch mainstream TV, but it does seem that the marketplace is creating opportunities to reach people through new ways, particularly with video and audio as the mechanisms.
So I like the way you're thinking about this in terms of trying to figure out a technology that's suited to expressing the message that you want to express. And in this case, with soldier testimonies, it's quite easy to imagine that you could put together a really compelling short video piece that would tell some stuff about this, and that you could probably get a lot of people to watch it. Because people would be interested to know what the experience of those soldiers are. Almost everybody knows somebody who's over there and feels nervous to ask different kinds of questions to those people. So that sort of a thing, you know, you wonder, well, okay, is video the thing? Should we use it for all of these projects? And maybe not. Maybe it's not the right tool for some of the other ones. What would you do for the Comcast issue? Or Dad?
Well, I just would recommend that people think back to yesterday and that little piece of video. That was made by just folks like us. And it had about it elements that you might fix to make it more potentially viral. That's quite possible. But it was a well-constructed strategy to try and make an argument that would have enough buzz to it that it could get out. And when you think about the elements of it, the things that gave it credibility, at least as I watched it, were, first of all, the guy himself was clearly somebody who spoke with a certain sense of authority from having been there. But then I was impressed at the interviews. There were interviews with two eminent professors
that kind of lent this expert quality to the discussion of a focused issue about the law of torture. And suddenly you were into an intelligent exploration of this subject, which to me, at any rate, was quite engaging. And when I think about our situation here in terms of our ability to do things, the one thing that's always impressed me is the invitational power that we have at our disposal. You can pretty much ask just about anyone in Cambridge, New York, wherever you're willing to go, if they will sit down with you and do some interview. So Dershowitz, absolutely, he's available. He passes out cards, you know, please interview me. And there are many people like that around. So the idea of actually crafting an argument in text and then in some way reifying it with the presentation of the authority of folk, that's something that's available to us. So when I'm thinking of the Comcast thing, I'm thinking, hey, I want to make some video. I want to put it up on CCTV. I'd like to have people get acquainted with the problem. And I'd like to find out why this guy is going to fob me off with these stupid things. And I'd love to be like the wonderful guy that did this, what was his name? The beautiful job that was done on the virtual world. And
Rob Corddry,
yeah. I mean, he was great. So I figure I can have a shot at that, or we could have a shot at that. That seems like strategy to me.
So are you advocating video as the medium for
anything? I don't know,
anything?
Not particularly. But yeah, video is very powerful. Video is extremely powerful. There is now a method to make it really simple. There's a method to edit it really simple. You can put it up in just a real small bit. My friend Glenn Brown, I just sent one around to you that was just kind of fun. You can put powerful elements into it. You can put it up, and you can then buzz it. You can get talk going about it. You can blog about it. You can send the links around. You can technorati it. You can pay attention to it. You can somehow see if you can't generate attention to it. And all right, that's the way you make an argument, I think. At least that's a start.
Well, I think maybe we'll wrap it up with that.
Feedback.
We're going to do feedback memos right now. So tell us what the questions are.
Oh, same. Take a sheet of paper. It's always the same. Blank sheet of paper. 3 basic questions. What's your positive, you know, big thought, positive, something expansive, something that's made your mind go, something that's caught your attention, something that snags your passion, something that's got your engine going. Then the negative, what you're afraid of, what you're worried about, what you think is going wrong. And then number 3, talk directly to us. You know, just say it. Whatever's on your mind. And number 4, sign it or not as you please. Leave it anonymous, put your own name, pseudonym, whatever you want. And number 5, if you want it not to be shared, write do not share. The default is that I will reproduce these and share them so that we all see where we stand.